Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, I love this song. This is Janine, and you're listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Party Internet Radio is a part of the Be the Media project. For a complete list of Coffee Party Radio Network shows, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com and click on radio shows. Consider joining our team, Be the Media. So I am normally joined on this show with my co-pilot, Loki King, and he seems to be MIA. Now, there have been some technical difficulties with Blog Talk, and if he pops up on the screen, we'll say hello and we'll reintroduce him. I see folks in the chat. Welcome, welcome. And I always ask the chat room to give me a little mic check because here on Blog Talk, I can hear you, but I can't hear myself. So if you give me a mic check, a volume check, I'd really appreciate it. So let's get right into this. Today is actually a two-part broadcast. For the Love of Labor will be my tribute to those who work for a living. But first, I want to spend just a couple minutes on something else. And I kind of call it the vote as the most essential ordinance in the people's army. There's a lot of banter on social media today about how voting is a farce, right? Lots of people are sharing lots of stories, making good cases for walking away, as though participation in a broken system is a betrayal of something, that voting is the first step towards the country we envision. In other words, participating in a broken system isn't a betrayal. It can be an effort to rescue. And the biggest piece of evidence I can offer is that too many people are working too hard to keep the people away from the polls for our vote to not matter. So we are disenfranchised. I mean, we are disenchanted. Actually, I want to talk about disenchantment first. We are disenchanted, and rightfully so. They mock us for caring. They mess with the vote count. They call us conspiracy nuts if we ask questions. They polarize us with snarky phrases and denigrating images. They drown us in meaningless sound bites. They clutter the media with non-issue reporting. I could go on. You could go on. That's disenchantment. This can't be right. But we are also disenfranchised, and it certainly feels deliberate. Voter rolls are purged. Voter ID gets more and more outrageous. Districts are gerrymandered. Arbitrary rules limit our options, our voting options, our enrollment options. And I could go on and on and on again, and so could you. So what do we do? So here's the philosophy, mine. Number one, we stick together. I think our selective outrage must become our collective outrage. And that's like saying, okay, maybe I don't understand how the price of ID is limiting, but people are saying the price of ID is limiting, and I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. And that's going to become a part of my collective outrage. Just an example. Number two, understand who they are. Who are they? When I said they do this and they do that, who is that who's doing it? And number three, have a plan to take them on. So I wrote a poem 2 years ago when we were upvoting mischief. I was hoping the time had passed to share it, frankly. But here we are, 2 years later, and things are really worse, not better at all. And so here it goes. I'm going to share my poem. But I have a lot of passion for what I try to say here. They say my vote ain't worth a dime, ain't worth the time to stand in line, but who they are will blow your mind. vote anyway. Big money wants us all to feel our civic duty isn't real. To blow it off is no big deal. Vote anyway. I need to vote. It's not a choice. The people need to use their voice. We're standing in the dust of their Rolls Royce. Vote anyway. We need the gals who get our nod to stop the guys who take our jobs, who take our homes, who take our land. It's time for me to take a stand. Vote anyway. Become a vote and take a friend. If we don't vote, this will never end. We have a message we must send. Vote anyway. Well, there it is. And I'm happy to say that Coffee Party USA, from now until the election, is planning to do everything in our power to encourage and support every citizen to vote. We'll use our website, Facebook, Twitter, email, Coffee Party Internet radio shows to share information on how to register, where to vote, what to do if your vote is blocked. We'll partner, collaborate, and share information with other organizations that support your vote, your powerful vote. But most of all, we'll let the world know why your vote matters, why you are powerful, and the mischief in American politics is officially on notice. We see you, and we will stop you. Say that again. We see you, and we will stop you. We the people. The Coffee Party Monthly newsletter will be out in a few days with all the details. If you don't get a copy in your in-basket for some reason, you can go to www.coffeepartyusa.com after Tuesday. There you'll find the newsletter as well as a page called /VoteAnyway. We've created a scoop it page called VoteAnyway, and we're using the tag #VoteAnyway to get information out there. I'm excited. I hope you see the possibility, too. And if you'd like to join this team, you can go to www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer/volunteer. I'm sure we'll find a job for you. And remember, this is just from now until the election. We and many others have plans after the election intended to prevent our having to wade through this malarkey again 4 years from now. So there you have it. You're the first to know. Vote Anyway is the official Coffee Party campaign from now until the day after voting or whenever counting stops. We know how that can go. And so I'm about to launch, but I want to remind folks that you can dial 646-929-2495. And if you want to speak with me on the phone, or you can go to our chat room and you can chat questions and answers, and we'll interact with you there. And I want to apologize in advance because, you know, one of the reasons we have more than one person on a show usually is because I know it can be crazy listening to one voice. So I really hope that we'll end up with Collins in a conversation with you. Okay. So here we are, for the love of labor. And I think you can tell by the way I named this broadcast how I feel about all this. I have been a working individual since I was 8 years old, and it's not an exaggeration. I lived in rural Oregon. I picked crops in the summer and did so until I was old enough to get a work permit. Then I worked in a cannery, and then I worked in a meatpacking plant, and I put myself through college, and I have worked my entire adult life. And I have a lot of respect for labor, and I have a lot of opinions about labor, as all of us do, who have at one time been a part of the workforce. But I want to start today by saying that I did a Labor Day broadcast 2 years ago that detailed the connection between the need to vote and the need for sustainable employment. On that show, we talked a lot about what it meant to vote for or against your personal self-interest. And that not voting clearly fell in the against your personal self-interest column. I think today we have a better understanding of how that's all possible. And if you'll bear with me, I'll try to draw that circle for you today. So just think about it. For a country that prides itself on a job well done, we seem to have allowed ourselves to fall out of love with our beloved work ethic. We've abandoned the idea that work is a virtue and therefore its own reward. And now we see wealth as a virtue. Whatever has to be done to obtain wealth is beside the point. In my humble opinion, we've exchanged a moral compass for a profit target. An economy-based work ethic, emphasis on ethic, to an amoral fiscal religiosity. I know those are big words, but man, I really believe it. So how else can one explain the death of the blue-collar middle class without so much as an obituary, let alone a funeral or a wake? If work is no longer the point, then who cares what happens to those who work or who cannot find work? The vilification of the unemployed and of the employed who cannot make it from paycheck to paycheck. I have a quote to share, and I honestly don't know how to credit it. So if someone in the chat room has a, you know, knows where this came from, I'm happy to see, happy to credit it. But it's very simple. Wealth is having money, earn money. And work is what you do if you don't have money. End quote. If money is the virtue, then work is the absence of virtue. This makes me a little sick to my stomach. So what happened? What happened? We seem to be very divided on this point. As Labor Day approaches, I can't help but notice how much of our polarization as a country is being driven by this new heartless economy. So here's some history to sort of put it in. The first annual observance of Labor Day was organized by the American Federation of Labor in 1884. That's a while ago. I always throw this in 1887, Oregon became the first state to designate Labor Day as a holiday, my Oregon. And in 1894, 10 years after the original declaration, Congress designated the first Monday in September a legal holiday for all federal employees and the residents of the District of Columbia. So we showed our love of labor then, our honor, our respect. Those were the days of Keynesian economics, the days of what we can very superficially call demand-side economics, for those of us who follow such things. It's a very superficial explanation, but it works. We all remember that there's this other way people used to think. And I'm going to try to not get too wonky right here. I'll try to get to basics, but sometimes I get carried away. Just go, stop in the chat room. But I remember the birth, or actually technically the rebirth, of voodoo economics, to quote George Bush the Elder. The supply side, trickle down, economic theory forwarded by the likes of President Reagan. This way of describing business is more properly called neoliberalism. Neoliberalism, for those who care about this wonky stuff, refers to a 20th century resurgence of a 19th century idea based on laissez-faire economic liberalism. That means the government walks away and the free market forces take over. Walking away includes non-intervention, deregulation, and removal of tax liabilities. Ooh. So the use of the word liberal is often confusing here, and, you know, I get it. Social or political liberals do not generally support neoliberal economics because of the predictable consequences of business without a social contract. Fool, this is not a social liberal idea. So up until about 1970 or so, in the 70s, the prevailing belief promoted by the media was that high levels of inflation, which were crazy, were the result of an oil supply shock. Now, supply shock means, oh, this is unexpected. But the oil supply shock was that there was not enough oil. And the resulting increase in the price of gasoline, which drove the prices of everything much higher. Many of us remember the gas shortage of that decade, the long lines, the crazy prices, and the, you know, the Oregon plan was the even odd day for gasoline. even license plates on one day, odd license plates on the other. Now, according to Keynesian economic theories, rising oil prices should have contributed to economic growth. In reality, the 70s was an era of rising prices and rising unemployment, inconsistent with that theory. So America and other first world nations sort of struggled for what else to do. They abandoned that strategy, and they favored the neoliberal notions that were being forwarded as an alternative. And those notions were that the economic growth was the job of unfettered business rather than the previously held belief that dangerous market fluctuations were to be managed by government. And remember, even the even odd day, you know, that was a government intervention. But somehow, even though that worked, we were to abandon those strategies. So if we'd maintained our Keynesian sensibilities, our response to the energy crisis should have been or might have been different. Perhaps an industry-government solution, partnership, like the development of alternative energy sources. But again, instead, we dug in. The world was faced with a shortage of oil. Just as demand was up, energy consumption grew tremendously post-World War II for two basic reasons, at least the actuarials will tell us this. One was the birth rate, hence boomers like me, and the medical advances leading to a longer lifespan, predominantly the use of antibiotics. So all of a sudden, more people were being born and fewer people were dying. Add to that sort of that post-war economic blitz that we were, you know, blitz is the wrong word, but it's like euphoria. Anyway, so oil prices made stuff more expensive. That's the basic truth. And instead of finding a cost-effective energy source, we advanced the idea that debt, I'm not kidding, that debt, especially consumer debt, was a good thing if it kept business as usual in place. And that's like saying, we're not going to change, so you can carry the ball, Mr. and Mrs. America. And we bought it. We bought it. Now, having lived through that time, I can tell you we sort of got fleeced into it. It wasn't like one day it was one way and the next day it was another. But hey, in 1969, the year I graduated from high school, the ratio of non-governmental debt, that's a fancy way to say consumer debt, mortgages, home loans, those things, was the ratio of non-governmental debt to gross domestic product, GDP, was 1-to-1. But at the time of the Great Collapse in 2008, the ratio was 3-to-1. And I got to tell you, GDP had grown. So holy moly. So my question to you is this. Is neoliberalism a failed experiment? I think I've given away, I think it is. And if it is, what's next? Almost 9 years into the Great Recession, we are finally beginning to reap the political whirlwind of the financial crisis. But how did this neoliberal approach manage to survive virtually unscathed for so long? Although it failed the test in the real world, bequeathing the worst economic disaster for 7 decades, politically and intellectually, it remained the only show in town. We couldn't think outside of that box. Here's the clincher, and here's where I'm trying to bring the circle back around to. Parties of the right, center, and left had all brought the solution into this philosophy. They knew no other way of thinking or doing. It had become common sense. But a common sense that cannot, did not, and will not survive the test of the real world. I mean, let's face it, a bailout is not laissez-faire. You know, so they accepted the solution, but they didn't accept the fact that they were now a bailout would have been a transgression of neoliberalism. Many of us talked about that, but not enough of us talked about that. So the faux common sense has been the darling of the social narrative that allows wealth to be worshipped, labor to be devalued, and poverty to be denigrated. Let me say that one more time. This faux common sense has been the darling of the social narrative that allows wealth to be worshipped, labor to be devalued, and poverty to be denigrated. Many have described the social chaos that comes from the dehumanization of our economic lives. And I'd like to read one of my favorites to you now. Now, this one is from Kurt Vonnegut, and I have to put on my Kurt Vonnegut voice. I can't read his stuff without sort of, I mean, I can't do it. I don't do an imitation, but it's not my voice that would read it. Too many years with kids and grandkids reading books, so I have to have the voice of the character. Here it goes. Quote, "Thus did a handful of rapacious citizens come to control all that was worth controlling in America. Thus was the savage and stupid and entirely inappropriate and unnecessary and humorless American class system created. Honest, industrious, peaceful citizens were classed as bloodsuckers if they asked to be paid a living wage. And they saw that praise was reserved henceforth for those who devised means of getting paid enormously for committing crimes against which no law had been passed. Thus the American dream turned belly up, turned green, bobbed to the scummy surface of cupidity unlimited, filled with gas, and went bang in the noonday sun." So that's Mr. Vonnegut, a quote from God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. What else can I say? So I hope that I brought this full circle to you. And I want to point to, I'm looking to the chat room now, that hopefully some of my chatters will call in so you can hear their voice and I'm not just reading their questions or their statements. But remember, anyone who's listening, 646-929-2495 is your call-in. And I'm seeing a lot of activity in the chat room. So before I go much farther, I'm going to check in with the chat room and see what's up. So here's one, exposing the thinking the money trail and the puppet strings would be world-changing crises and wars of the last four decades. The shock doctrine is the gripping story of how America's free market policies have come to dominate the world. Ah, that's a book. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm looking for Tudor Magic. Biz Tudor Magic says, because capital investment is what makes additional labor necessary. I wish I had read that in the where it was applicable. So here's my question. What can we do? So interestingly enough, the same plan we discussed earlier when I talked about the power of the vote works here, the same bones of a plan. One is that we stick together, that our selective outrage must become our collective outrage. Two is we understand who they are. And I think our conversation about neoliberalism sort of points to that. And three, have a plan to take them on. Now, let's take these one at a time, but remember, the idea is not to go back to anything. I mean, some people say, let's go back to the Keynesian strategy, let's reinforce the neoliberal strategy, whatever. But the idea here that I'm proposing is that we don't want to go back, but that we be informed by the past and create the economy for the 21st century outside the box of our media-induced coma. If economic theory can be promoted, can be so woven into the American narrative that we can't see outside of it to something else, then what can we do? to be able to do that. Obviously, one thing is to change the narrative, which is what our Be the Media project is all about. But I, you know, again, there's more here than meets the eye. Labor has been and should be, in my opinion, an honored and respected component of American society. Now, do you want to go back to the heyday of unions? I don't know. Do you? I understand the need for a union. I also know that as a woman, in my day, unions didn't help me much. I understand they might be a little different now, but is that the solution? How does the American worker find its rightful place in society? And what do we do so if there isn't even an opportunity to be an American worker? I mean, seriously, I could find a job when I was young enough, actually too young to work. And that's just not true for my children, and it's impossible for my grandchildren. There is not work. Why? It's somewhere else. We're competing with the global market now. And people can work for a dollar a day and replace people who need to work for a living wage. So I'm looking to the chat room since you're there. But I am definitely interested in what kind of solutions can occur outside the box. What kind of country would this be if wealth and work were at least equally honored? What would it be if our work ethic were really restored? What would it be if, how do I want to say this, dignity of the means of production were restored to the American worker? So, I can tell you some things I don't, and I'm waiting for input, but here's a few things that's occurred to me. Let's just pick one of the battle cries that we're talking about, how the price of an American education now puts people in a terrible position, now puts people in a, you know, they owe more, the price of a new house just to have gone through college, for example, or frankly, to go through some of the trade schools that are available. And how did that happen? I mean, when I went to school, when I went to college, I paid $125 term. That same university now is over $3,000 per term. I was able to get a minimum wage job to work during the school year that probably paid a dollar. Maybe it was approaching $2 an hour. And that was, again, in the 60s. And today, minimum wage in places outside the West, well, the federal minimum wage is like 7.5. In Oregon, we're approaching $10 an hour, but you can see the differentiation, right? And part of the problem here is that back in the day, entry-level employees were paid to be trained on the job. You didn't go to the community college to become a welder. You took a job as and were paid to become a welder while you acted in support of welders on the job. But today, employers expect employees already trained by tax-supported institutions and using student debt. So instead of being trained on the job, people are going into debt, that magic debt, so that employers have no investment in their employees, none, or less. Much, much less than we used to have. Add to that the fact that a part of this neoliberal structure was to remove tax liability. So we see loopholes and tax and reduced rates of tax on business and the wealthy, all that, well, we have for many years, especially approaching the years approaching the Great Recession. I'm forgetting now how many of those years capital gains were taxed at 0%, but there were several, and during the Bush administration. So here you not only have employers not investing in their employees, but you have tax-supported institutions picking up the slack and business not even contributing to the taxes to support those institutions. Talk about an ugly circle. So I do see a hand up. and I'm going to open the mic for area code 951. And I see this been area code 951. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Hello, Janine. How are you this evening or this afternoon?
Oh, well, for me, it's barely afternoon, but yes, I'm doing great. And who is this?
This is Mike Harris. I'm part of the Coffee Party, one of your family here in Southern California.
Excellent, Mike. I don't have a good file standing by for what the phone numbers mean, but welcome to the show. What would you like to contribute today?
Well, we're talking about labor and employment, and you're speaking about wondering where the money went. And the if you go on, of course, you know, Wikipedia, you'll find out the United States Department of Defense is the largest employer of the world. And it was interesting when we hit this Great Recession, and one of the solutions to that, to try to erase some of our deficit, was a sequestration of our budget. And unfortunately,
yes,
not necessarily unfortunately, but the defense budget fell under that. And there was a lot of congressional uproar about trying to get that fixed after they went to such lengths to get cut other parts of the budget that were regarding social services to protect basically,
yes,
the interests within their own congressional districts. You know, it employs a lot of people in Texas to make tanks and armory, you know, along with all the other places in Virginia and throughout the United States. You know, interestingly enough, the third largest, which is employer in the world, is Walmart. And Walmart, the majority of their products are made overseas, with the majority of those coming from the Republic of China. So one could almost make the connection that China, by proxy, controls American labor. And if you look right above, you know, on the list of largest employers, the second largest employer is the People's Liberation Army in China. So it's kind of interesting that China, which also holds the largest, I guess, amount of debt in the United States, controls the largest private employer, Walmart. You know, that,
yes,
is a bit of a logical step, or I guess a logical fallacy, depending on which way you want to connect it. But it's, I think, an important point that a lot of people don't really make the connection.
I do, too. I think it's very important to point to all these little loops. I'm so glad that you brought up sequestration, because, man, that was a bee in my bonnet when it was happening. And frankly, we have yet to recover. We have yet to recover from this. And it's interesting, because I found that tell me, you seem to be knowledgeable about this, but this seemed to be a gateway to a lot of privatization. You know, it was the whole, we don't have the money, we can hire someone, we don't have to invest in, you know, blah, 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 that whole conversation. And privatization is proven to be a huge tax burden, and to have not fulfilled its promise, you know, in terms of we do a better job for less money. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting how some of the solutions back then actually became today's problems.
Absolutely. It really takes puts an enormous pressure on collective bargaining. And, you know, and we've seen that in the loss of the amount of people that are in unions. The only really area where you see a growth in unions is if you're a policeman, they will support their own unions, but they don't seem to want to support labor unions, and, you know, politically. And if you're a teacher, it seems like the right doesn't want to support their unions, and that feel that they're affecting the education of Americans. But, you know, on the other hand, they'll support private industrial prison guards, and really go after their support when they're in their election campaigns. So, you know, as 33 and a half years as a former iron worker, local 433 Los Angeles, and, you know, having worked all my life, you know, out there in the labor force, you know, it's, I really see that the economic changes that have happened.
Boy, I couldn't agree with you more. I do think that this whole notion that you point to the perfect example, which is the police unions who support themselves but don't support other expressions of organized labor, is what I was pointing to or tried to point to when I talked about how our selective outrage should become our collective outrage. In other words, law enforcement has issues it needs to deal with, correct? And they should support their collective bargaining ability, but not just for wages and their compensation package, but also for their safety on the job and, you know, the tools at their disposal and the training that they need to walk around with deadly force. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I totally get it. But why they differentiate themselves, why they hold themselves unique to other organizations, I don't understand. Because my collective outrage embraces them, even though my selective outrage, the thing that will grab me around the throat and hurt my family and friends, is different. And in my case, my husband's a retired university professor and, you know, stuck around in that job for 45 years because he was trading wages for retirement, right? And that was the agreement. You know, out here in Oregon, we didn't have a lot of money to spend on that, but we could, you know, contribute to a meaningful pension. And now there's, you know, those pensions are being attacked and they're being denigrated and they're being turned into, you know, these icky little private accounts that have no power, right? And why others aren't outraged, I have no idea.
That's a perfect example of how the financial institutions have used, government pension programs. You get perfect example, CalPERS, I believe, is the largest public employee union fund, and it took an enormous hit during the Great Recession when they were like the last one holding the bag when they bought into these investments.
Yes.
I guess that was the credit default swaps that they were rated to have a lot higher, I guess, double or triple A or whatever the rating was, than they actually were. And that was the fault of both LIBOR and S&P, which were got away scot-free over it and left CalPERS holding
yes.
the bag on something. They were sold a bag of goods.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually call that harvesting. Like every time there's a quote-unquote market correction, all I see is a harvest, because all the little guys get harvested, the big guys recover in a few nanoseconds of electronic trading, right? And the little personal retirement accounts get gutted. And it's the same kind of mischief, right? We're really not fair competitors with the big guys in the market. We can't do our trades in nanoseconds. And so even when you've got a buy or sell order in, go ahead.
Sure, yeah. No, I'm sorry to interrupt. I know where you're going with it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and don't worry about interrupting me, because I've never had a moment of quiet space I didn't think was my permission to talk. So
yeah.
It's a character flaw I work on every day.
No.
Go ahead. Well, you know, I just wanted to bring what we were just talking about back to this whole notion of, you know, how Walmart need China, you know, really comes back to the ultimate challenge for the American worker is that the largest employer in our country isn't in our country. And
sure.
I consider that this huge challenge. You know, what So first of all, you know, when at sort of towards the end of my soliloquy here, we talked about, now what do you do? And one of the things you have to do is first stick together. Second is to know who they are, you know, the sources of the mischief. And the third is have a plan. And, you know, so right now my plan with Walmart, for example, is one, I don't shop there. And, you know, and the counter move to that is that I shop in as local an institution as I can, because I actually know those people work here, you know. And the other thing, though, is to understand that profiting from the actions of organizations like Walmart, not just saving a buck on a gallon of milk, but investing in companies like that is actually like taking a knife, pointing it in front of myself, then lifting my arm until the knife comes in between my shoulder blades. You know, I'm doing myself in. And yet that is the mischief of globalization. You know, that is the mischief of investing in these companies that really aren't American citizens. They are citizens of the world. They'll be the first to tell you that. And that's even a part of their justification for not paying taxes. You know, we are the keepers of the global economy, not we are your neighbors who work side by side, right?
And, yes, and it has a lot to do with,
you know,
where capital flows.
Yes.
When we had the Great Recession and the current administration was entering office, the newly appointed Secretary Clinton of the State Department, her first visit was to go to China, and that was to secure funds for bonds, because to help bail out these banks. And in the meantime, China was busy dumping solar panels on the U.S. market. And it was that was the main reason why, I guess it was Solera, who had pioneered technology that was going to revolutionize the solar industry. And they basically went belly up because they couldn't match the cost from what they invested in to develop what they had done in the United States. It was the U.S. company. But the Commerce Department never intervened because it's too delicate of a situation going against somebody that holds all of your debt. It was one of the same reasons why the American television manufacturers went belly up right at the time of the during the Reagan administration, because the Commerce Department wouldn't intervene. In the first place that old Uncle Ronnie Reagan went to after he left office was the $2 million speaking fee in Japan. No U.S. television manufacturers are in existence that manufacture on U.S. soil after Reagan left office. Before he went into office, nearly every television in an American's living room was manufactured on U.S. soil.
Yes, yes. I'm glad. I noticed you called them ray guns. That's, I don't know if that's just a West Coast thing or not, but yeah, it's definitely.
Well,
the,
it was because of his
the governor that changed California.
Yes, yeah. I grew up in California, lifelong resident of California, and I saw what he did with dumping the homeless onto the streets, and I saw what he did with free speech at Berkeley. I saw how his disdain for labor, and I saw how he broke the union for the air traffic controllers, and then turned around and gave all of those newly employed traffic controllers the same things that the union was asking for, but he busted the union in doing it.
Yes, yes, I remember that. It was a terrible day. It was a terrible time, as president, but also as governor. He did much of what you alluded to had to do with his work as governor. And, you know, to this day, people still come to Oregon from California to go to college because even though they have to pay out-of-state tuition, they can graduate in 4 years. And you can't graduate in 4 years in a California, state of California university because it's overcrowded and they can't get your classes. So it takes a minimum of 5 years to get a technical degree there. And so that's just a direct result of what Governor Reagan did to the state system of higher ed in California back then. It's crazy making. The other, now, there's a comment in the chat room that's kind of relevant to what you're saying, where you started with this, Mike. It says, Biz Tutor Magic says, the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation both seem to favor globalization. Yet Hillary Clinton didn't write the book, It Takes a Globe. Her book was It Takes a Village. And I, now, isn't that an interesting juxtaposition? Because it really is true that when I see solving problems, you know, here in my neck of the woods, it does take a village. But the global village is a much more difficult thing to navigate. And it's because you don't, it's not me and the guy who's making my iPhone in conversation. It's my wireless provider and, or, you know, my cell phone provider and that person's manufacturing partner. And you know what I mean? It's just like the gobbledygook you get with the TPP. It's like all so, what's the word I want to use? So here's my notion, and I apologize that I'm actually revealing who I am in this matter, but here it goes. We talk about radicalized religion, and we fear it desperately. But what I see in action today is radicalized business, and I think that we should fear it as much. And radicalized really just means how I think transcends any reason that you have for thinking differently, right? I mean, ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And once you're on the wrong side of my beliefs, then I have no social, moral, ethical responsibility for what happens to you. And so it feels like business has radicalized itself, at least, you know, I hate to say business, big business, wealth builders, globalized industry. That's what I'm speaking to. You know, I was an employer. I had 40 employees in 3 Western states. We were all local, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, I can make a couple $1 million a year, but it doesn't put me in the same bucket with those guys. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, absolutely.
You know, right.
We shouldn't be naive to understand the globalization of capital. And right now, as it is, that the United States is seen as like not necessarily emerging capital, but maybe something that is in decline. And so capital follows labor. Now, just to say, you know, that wouldn't be saying that you're advocating neoliberalism, because that countries such as Germany protect their workers. The majority of the workers are union, and they have a lot higher standard of living. Yes, they pay a little bit more for taxes and social services, but they have probably a lot better life as far as what their community offers. You know, and I think one of the most important aspects that people don't really want to look at and is how the United States ranks for mortality, how the United States ranks for math and science scores, how the United States ranks for poverty level, how the United States ranks in a number of things. So it all goes back to, you know, what probably is very important that your show is based on is voting and participation, because, you know, our elected officials don't have to hand away our legacy. It's absolutely imperative that they don't have to do that. It's just the short-term the short-term vision. That's the mistaking that, you know, they have to raise this money for their next election. They have to, the businessman has to look for in competition for his cheapest source of labor, because his competition is already there. You know, and, you know, I'm not advocating necessarily a trade war, because we've seen what in World War One that happened. You know, there were tariffs that drove a lot of countries to oppose each other. Now, we're not going to have a war with China, because they're our main trading partners. But it doesn't mean that we, you know, have to just give away the house.
Well, you said a lot, and I couldn't agree more with just about all of it. I liked especially what you said about short-term vision. Short-term vision is explained in my notion by the fact that we're trying to still operate within this economic strategy that has failed us. And so we keep trying to do the quick fix, the quick fix, the quick fix, right? And certainly the short-term vision that you pointed to in terms of, you know, how our elected think that they have to get money on their side so they can maintain their elected status, that they can, you know, they have to make compromises and all of that. That's even more buying into this failed system. It's almost as though if this particular, if neoliberalism, I want to think of a better, you know, if trickle-down economics went away, I think a lot of the pressure on our elected would also go away. See what I'm saying? If we once again tax wealth, if we once again tax business profits, if there was such a thing as profit. I mean, back when I started my company, every year we did tax planning because there actually were taxes in the beginning, right? And so we'd invest in infrastructure. We'd buy new computers or software. We'd hire more people. We'd do everything that we could do that was furthered our business plan at the expense of taxes, because they things like your computers and your software and your labor force and their compensation package were all, quote unquote, tax deductible. And so they reduced our tax liability by investing in our company, right? Well, you don't have to do that anymore because there are virtually no taxes against big business. I mean, they spend more, these big global interests spend more on lobbyists than they do on taxes. And many of them pay no taxes, yes, as you know, and some of them actually get tax returns in excess of whatever they may have paid in. So they actually get paid by us. And so the whole idea that, you know, small business continues to have the cost of doing business being an essential thing, and investment in ourselves is still a valuable strategy. But for these guys that we're talking about, the ones that have the balance of trade in their hands, it's not true. So they don't have to invest in employee benefits. They don't have to invest in employee development. They don't have to invest in infrastructure. As a matter of fact, a lot of them sell off their infrastructure and rent it back, you know? And then that company will fail, and then another company will come in. I mean, it's really opportunistic, as though somebody out there knows that the system is going to collapse. As a matter of fact, I can't believe it collapsed 9 years ago and we're still here, right?
Well, there's that little thing called quantitative easing, which is just a euphemism for printing more money.
Well, that's true, printing more money, and also not having the biggest movers of money involved in the village. You know, our school districts in Oregon are Banco, right? And that started when we did property tax limitation that really only benefited business. And, you know, Oregon has the lowest corporate business tax in the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we remember is back in the 50s and 60s when I was in public school, right, we had a stellar and enviable education system. So people my age remember that. And they don't see what's happening now. What happens when there's no money to fund teachers, let alone facilities, let alone, you know what I'm saying? So there's kind of this dual action of backing out of the village. Go ahead.
Yes, well, there's been a bit of a paradigm shift in how budgets are maintained. You know, for instance, in the city that I live in, Fontana, we've raised and sent our kids off to college. Now close to 60% of the city's budget, and it's by no means a small one, goes to law enforcement. Whereas before it used to be, you know, larger parts were more social services like public education. When I was a kid, I was bused to school for a while. And the buses are fairly non-existent as far as moving kids around these days. It's basically parents. When I was a kid, the class sizes were about 23 to 28. Now they're ranging around up in the 40s. And just to go back into where the private sector, which has been shrinking as far as the labor force, has been growing in public sector, the budget for most cities, the majority of it, that goes towards law enforcement. As an example, we have a police officer that we're not too fond of, you know, in the cannabis community, because that's where I do a lot of my work. This police chief, Ed Basenko, makes $302,000 a year. To put that in perspective, the governor of California makes $223,000
a year.
And
really?
The majority. I've cleared that with California Transparency, that basically is just a public entity that you can look up public officials' money. The almost half the money that the chief makes is through a thing called asset forfeiture, where he gets a share of the stuff he takes down. And the majority of the crime is shifted. The majority of the their emphasis is going after the cannabis grows. And being in somewhat of a rural county, within 2008, there was a story about they were running on fumes. And they shifted their emphasis from crime, where there was a victim, say, you know, robberies, car thefts, you know, assaults, to going after cannabis crimes. And the sheriff was quoted as, that's where the money is at. So basically, you know, to use your phrase, harvesting is what basically is happening across the country. The governments are harvesting their people. The growth sector is in the prison population growth. Growth sector is in public services for law enforcement. The growth sector is in the first largest employer in the United States, the Defense Department. Basically, we're just a guns and butter country now. I mean, that's kind of a wild statement. Go on.
Well, but I know what you're saying. I mean, on the 4th of July, I put up a meme that said, you know, make America a first world country again, because, you know, it feels like for so many of us, we're not, you know, and I'm out here on coasting on the edge because of my age, right? I came through the economic system at a time when economic stability in the future was still possible, right?
As did I.
But, oh, yes. And so, by the way, I should have told you that you got a sort of a high five from Biz Tutor Magic, and he said, I agree that giving away the house is an idea as there is out there at the moment. You know, so he's following along and agreeing with you about that. So, I concur that this whole harvesting thing is ubiquitous, and we find it in many, many ways. You know, at the school, you have to, you have to pay now to be on a sports team, and it's not a small amount of money. Good grief, we considered participation in sports a development of citizenship and, you know, share, teamwork, all of that, and B, something kids did instead of getting in trouble. So it was a good investment, right? And now,
I would agree in part on that, although also, you know, just to make a disclosure of myself, I'm also a registered nurse licensed in the state of California, although I haven't practiced recently, so I'm kind of keep up on the developing trends on health. Now, I think that the public school system should basically outlaw tackle football because of the CTE that can develop later on in life, the chronic traumatic encephalopathy
that
develops from concussions. It's bumper brains.
I agree completely. Yes. My boys were not allowed to play football as soon as it wasn't, you know, flag football at recess out on the grass, you know,
yeah,
that's
you know,
it.
My
degree is
in
public health, so I know exactly. Huh?
I grew up playing sports, and I'm a real big football fan. I still watch it, but, you know, I have this guilt about knowing, you know, what they're doing. And the professional athletes are aware of this now. They really are, and it makes me feel like we're paying, you know, a gladiator blood sport now, where people that don't have any economic way of bettering themselves basically sacrifice their own minds in order to gain economic freedom.
Yeah, well, and if you're anywhere near my age, you also remember that we used to play all kinds of things. There was, you know, football is what people might think about, but we played soccer. We played, as a matter of fact, we were some of the first in the nation here to play soccer, but all kinds of lesser non-contact sports, track and field, baseball, tennis, swimming, skiing. I mean, you know, it was like, how do you play? And then a lot of these things were just intramural, you know, volleyball, whatever. But the thing is, I think the point I was trying to make, but I totally appreciate what you were saying, because there is actually an economic downstream misery associated with, you know, I cringe when I see these little teeny guys armoring up for football, or when I see these little teeny guys. I don't even really like the baseball, the national baseball playoffs for these little kids. I just think it's too far, too much. But that's just me. Coming back to how we got here, that we cannot fund basic things. We can't fund driver's training anymore. We can't fund, you know, you name it, we can't fund it.
Yeah, that's
how do
back
we
to
bring
my statement about the paradigm shift from public services to thinking from fear that we need the majority of our budget to go for law enforcement, which, you know, isn't really the case, because crimes have been dropping since probably the mid-60s. But the increase in law enforcement has gotten to where, basically, you know, it's hard to tell whether or not these are soldiers on our streets or, you know, police on the beat.
Well, and yes. As a matter of fact, one way that really came home to me this year is I own a house in Hawaii. I live there with my sister a good part of the time. And so I was there all summer this summer, and for the first time in my life, I saw indigenous, they're contractor law enforcement on the Big Island. I had never seen them. They were obviously post-military, paramilitary, you know, standing there looking like they were on the president's detail, you know. And it's always before been, I mean, the joke was if you were Chinese, you could be a policeman. But the point was there were people, small statue people, with white gloves and a lovely uniform, right? And they were directing traffic, or they were pursuing criminals, whatever they were doing. And this time I saw these darn mercs on the road, and they creeped me out totally. It's like, what is this? You know, I mean, the whole Big Island doesn't have a population of 200,000. And we've got these guys? What is that about? You know? Some dog killing your chickens is one of the biggest crimes, other than, you know, domestic violence. Domestic violence is there. How is this possible? So, again, getting back to, if we wanted this paradigm to shift back, if we honestly believe that a healthy work ethic trumps the notion of wealth as a virtue in itself, what do we do? And so I'm thinking from your conversation so far, you're a guy who performs or lives a life out of an ethical base. You have a morality that you try to live consistently with. And some of those, I'm sure, given how informed you are, have to do with what is a just economic system, and how do I support that system now, and what would make it easier in the future? Is that too big a question?
No. It's I agree quite a bit with what candidate Sanders was stumping on his campaign, that we need to really cut back on a lot of the spending that basically just makes our both security as a country and our economic viability just unsustainable, and that's our military budget. We have 800 bases around the world. I can't think of a single country that has a base on our soil. We have our largest budget going to the military. And then on a local levels, our largest budget goes to law enforcement. You know, and America, for being land of the free, seems like we're a gulag now. And that both, you know, our economic policies affect us in a way at home that is not sustainable for, you know, a healthy environment in which to grow. You know, if we were reinvesting in the people, into our crumbling infrastructure, and the Democrats have been railing about this for decades. You know, our bridges are collapsing. Our buildings are just not up to code. You know, a good earthquake is going to crumble a lot of stuff. You know, having been in the construction industry, buildings that were built before the 1970s have a lot different types of engineering. Even during the Northridge earthquake, they found out that the building standards in regards to welding, that they were using a rod that was called a wire that was called 211 nickel rod, and it passed the standards in the labs for structural integrity. But it turns out, as workers tend to do, they increase their productivity by speeding up the wire and turning it up to where it made the welds too hot as they were cooling. And when those welds cooled, it would leave cracks that weren't detectable under the ultrasound when the inspectors looked at them. But as it fatigued through the years, all it took is a good shake. Now, it was the Northridge Hospital, which I had worked on after the quake. Some of those columns were sheared completely in half, and if they had had a second quake that was just enough, those columns would have displaced, and you would have seen a very large loss of life. And, you know, it's just one of those things that that we're not putting back into our infrastructure, because they depend so much on privatization that the self-interest of the shareholder trumps the interests of the community at large.
Absolutely. The community at large, generally and specifically, American workers. You know, shareholders and their dividends have become more of a concern for people in the boardroom than anything else, because, you know, in a nanosecond, they can be left behind. That money can move somewhere else. And this has become an OPM world, in other people's money. You know, all of these fortunes and all of these dynasties operate on someone else's money. But I have to, maybe I should insert just a second here. Those of us on the West Coast are totally clear what the Northridge quake was and what seismic things are and how shearing, especially in an afterquake, is actually more deadly than the original quake often. And so I apologize to anyone who doesn't know these things, but I think the point, rather than specifics, which are very real to Mike and to me, well, and frankly to me in Oregon and in Hawaii, there was a 3.6 at my house in Hawaii today, is that infrastructure doesn't just mean how many lanes are on your interstate, and it doesn't just mean, although it should mean, bridges, but it's also alternative transportation. It's also how plumbing and, you know, sewer, water, electrical, you name it. It's actually how society functions as a unit, as opposed to, you know, there's, instead of 100,000 individuals with their own wells and their own septic and their own whatever, that we join forces and solve problems in the commons. As a matter of fact, many of us remember or have knowledge of, let's put it that way, that, you know, electricity didn't used to go everywhere in America. And it was the government that did, conducted the project, the electrification of rural America. And then private companies came in and took over that quote-unquote burden. But, you know, it's crazy-making when it's obvious that if we join forces, there are all kinds of problems we can solve together. Want to have a light rail that runs from Canada to Mexico over here in our neck of the woods, Mike? That is a problem we can solve in the commons. That's something we can do together if we see a value. And it's something that we always have to struggle against the private interests who, rather than being satisfied with being hired to build these things, want to own them. And so, you know, the fact that there could be microfractures in the welds meant that somebody was not, you know, was trying to push the standard of production, right? And for what reason? Not so that you got a better compensation package. It was so that some shareholder got a better dividend. And there are lots of stories, success stories as well as failure stories from the Northridge earthquake. People who were over time and over budget, but had their structures stand. You know, whether they were overpasses over the freeway or whether they were hospitals. And interestingly enough, those people that invested that kind of asset into the results had results that succeeded, as opposed to those that made money, got in, got out, and boom, things went away. So there's a whole body of knowledge out there about that work ethic again. So in 2005 I divested, right? I sold everything I could sell that wasn't just local, right? I mean, you can have a bond for your local school, you know, for the library, whatever, but I divested from all things global. And I shop at my co-op, and I, you know, walk as much as I can instead of driving. As a matter of fact, I'm moving from where I live now so that I can walk almost everywhere. I'm old enough, I have to think about that anyway, you know. Get close to the bus system. I'm out here in the urban forest outside the city, and it's lovely, but it's crazy. I'm investing in solar in my new house. I'm investing in, you know, things that happen by the people, for the people. I mean, at some point, there has to be a way for us to back away. You know, we don't have to, you know, necessarily hit big business in the schnoz, right? Knock them out, DKO. But we certainly can not contribute to the success of that business model if indeed we're going to change that model. Because, like, as I said earlier, the 21st century economy, it doesn't have to be going back to something in the past, something that worked better than now. It doesn't have to be an adaptation of what's happening today. It can be something very different, informed by what's happening now, informed by what's happening before Governor, then President Reagan, informed by lessons we learned in the Great Depression, yes? And my struggle always, as sort of an economic creature, a retired business owner, and someone who lived through better times and is very sympathetic to current times, you know, what do we do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you're going up against a capital that follows labor on a market that's open 24/7. And, you know, we're in an aging market, so capital's not going to necessarily move towards us. And, you know, if a politician has to spend the majority of his time raising funds for the next election, it's kind of a tough question. I don't think I really have the answer for it this time.
Well, and you know what? I don't either. You know, to me, this is the question of our time. But I think what you talked about earlier is a key to how we answer it, and that is that candidate Sanders, candidate Stein, lots of people, including the mainstream candidates, have thoughts on the effect of money in politics, have thoughts about what it would take to free the elected from the tyranny of having to go to bed with big money in order to even be elected, right? Free the elected from the need to raise money like that, to make promises, to become beholden, and actually free them to represent us. And I think that there's a lot of good minds in this country that could do better, could come together, including you, Neiman, you know, and contribute to the story, what's our economic future going to be if there weren't all these lobby-weighted, campaign contribution-weighted, what do you want to call them? It's like smothering the conversation with the reality of money in politics. It's like snuffing us out. You know, like we're a fire trying to, you know, we're embers trying to flame, and we just keep getting the oxygen taken away because there's so many quote-unquote considerations. I mean, even when we talk about China, remember the biggest debtor, the United States is more in debt to Social Security than it is to China, you know. And so we forget those things. We forget, you know, Belgium's one of those guys out there. I mean, there's all kinds of little truths that don't never get to pop out, or they don't become a part of the common thing. And I think a good step towards helping people understand that this blinding paradigm of neoliberal economics, right? The thing that blinds us so much that we can't even think outside that box for solutions, I think it would help us see beyond that paradigm if our elected were free to think outside that box. There you go. There's my coffee party spiel.
Yeah, it would probably help if some of the pressure was off if Glass-Steagall was to be reinstituted. And that you would take a lot of the money away from politics, but unfortunately the Citizens United has changed all that, where it's actually it's a pretty good investment, and it's probably one of the reasons why you saw 17 candidates on the Republican ticket, because even if you don't win, the way super PACs are structured now, and if you have a backdoor channel into the financial interest of that PAC, you can spend a little bit of money running for a while, and then when you decide to fold up the tents, you can walk away with a sizable income without any trace of it. And, you know, it used to be called money laundering or even electioneering to some respect, but that's the reality of how the financial thing of politics runs today.
Well, it's true, money laundering, electioneering, but it was also called like a RICO scam. We're not applying these laws to these people. You know, and I totally agree that I just think that's the egg we have to crack, this sort of incestuous notion of the money, politics influence, money, politics influence, you know, that sort of the ball that's rolling. And I had something brilliant to say, but it's basically like, I think it's important to remember that if we'd had Citizens United before Henry Ford, we'd still be having horses and being drawn in carriages. You know, the horse and carriage industry would have won the day.
And that attempt was made in the late 19th century by the railroads, and it was defeated. So it's not a new concept.
No, it's the robber barons. The robber barons are amazing. But so exactly, it's like if we could actually take an honest look at our history and what worked for us and what didn't, and then reinterpret it to the technology and the industry of today, we don't even know where it would take us, right? All we know is that all these other forces are trying to keep us where we are, right? Status quo is where the money is right now. The money is afraid of doing anything other than making more money from money, you know, see what I'm saying? It's like holy moly. And yet, once we busted out of those past paradigms, wonderful and amazing things happened. And it doesn't take too long before the opportunism to grow in each of those, I know. And to me, the ideal future economic system would have this self-doubting do-loop about opportunism. You know, it's one thing to say there's opportunity, like here's a chance for you to build your own business because there's, you know, this skill set needed and this product would be useful, right? And opportunism is really saying, hey, these other people are doing this great thing and I want in. It's a whole different story, even though those words are like two letters apart. And I just noticed that we're like 6 minutes from the end of our time, but gosh, I've so much enjoyed our conversation, Mike.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Absolutely.
Let's go and close. And you have a wonderful evening, and keep the faith.
Keep the faith is exactly right. And thank you so much, Mike. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm going to close with my little bit that I call my NPR moment, which is basically to remind our listeners that Coffee Party USA is totally a crowdsourced organization. It is the contributions and memberships of people like you that fund this organization. Citizens United has not benefited us. We are an all-volunteer organization with a couple of minor exceptions, people from whom we must purchase skill sets. And other than that, everything else from the board of directors to the managers of volunteers to all the volunteers themselves, we are all one big volunteer family. And so virtually every penny that comes into Coffee Party USA provides the infrastructure, provides, you know, our access to the web, our access to social media, any and all outreach we do. The board of directors even has to pay its own way to our annual meeting as individuals. So if you'd like to contribute to this effort, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com and hit the big red button that says become a member. And on that page, you'll have the chance to be a monthly member, an annual member, or just to make a donation. So look for those three options on that page. I can't thank you enough for your participation. And I can't thank our chat room and our caller today enough. This has been a great conversation, and I hope we all walk away with the notion that we can make a difference. Our vote will make a difference. Post-election strategy to remove money from politics will make a difference, and that we can, as a community and as a community of communities, create the conversation that makes a sustainable economic future for us all. My thanks to all those in the labor movement who came before me. My thanks to all the people who work for a living, and my thanks to those who are trying to work for a living. And I will honor you deeply and sincerely on this Labor Day. Thanks very much, everybody.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the most.